Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Bayer offered $62 billion, that's with a B, to acquire Monsanto. And in part of that deal, they would take on about $8 billion in debt. But Monsanto turned them down and basically said that they were worth more than what Bayer was willing to pay. And that said, Monsanto didn't completely shut them down. They said they'd be open to negotiating the terms of some sort of eventual deal down the line.
That's Luke Runyon talking about Bayer's bid to buy Monsanto, the biotech business headquartered in Missouri. If the deal goes through, it would create the largest seed and farm pesticide business in the world. Luke's a reporter for Harvest Public Media and KUNC in Fort Collins, Colorado. We called him to get the scoop on what this could mean for farmers and consumers. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Evan.
This is the biggest proposed deal in biotech we've seen this year, but actually, there are several other proposed mergers in the works. Could you tell us about those and where they are in the review process?
There's been a ton of movement in this particular sector with farm chemicals and seeds and among these really big companies. And a lot of that has been taking place in the last 2 years or so. So one of the first deals is ChemChina, also known as China National Chemical. And they made a $46 billion bid for Syngenta, which is another chemical company. And because ChemChina is owned by the Chinese government, it'll have to go through this really long review process before it could ever be okayed here in the U.S. And then the SEC and antitrust regulators would have to do their own review of that particular deal. And then you have another big merger that's in the works between Dow and DuPont. That's another couple huge chemical companies that have agricultural interests, and they're also interested in merging. Some analysts expect that deal to close during the second half of this year. And that review process is a little less complex because they're based here in the U.S. And I'd say that the Dow-DuPont deal hasn't gotten as much attention as the Monsanto-Bayer deal or the ChemChina-Syngenta deal, but you have all of these big mega mergers in the works. They're all huge companies with multinational reaches, and so there's a lot of regulatory hurdles, not just here in the U.S., but in other countries that they'd have to jump through before anything is ever finalized.
But it's huge. You're basically taking this one industry, seeds and pesticides, and you are moving it from six players to three.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. And essentially what we're talking about is consolidation in farm inputs, which is not the sexiest topic, I know. But these companies, they churn out everything from livestock drugs to tractors to seeds to pesticides to fertilizers. And these companies that do this, this is already really consolidated. A lot of the consolidation happened in the late 1990s. And these three deals that are in the works, they're all in different stages of progress. But if they go through, you're looking at more than 75% of the market for farm chemicals and for seeds being owned by three companies instead of six. So it could really shake up the farm economy and in turn trickle down to really shake up our food system.
Now, I know that when people hear the names of these companies, their mind automatically goes to GMO seeds. Do these companies also produce regular hybrid seeds?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think when you're referring to that, you're referring to the boogeyman Monsanto. And Monsanto is well known for its genetically engineered seeds, but they're a really broad company. They produce a lot of hybrid seeds, and actually about half of their business is traditionally bred vegetable seeds. They own quite a few subsidiaries that deal in seeds that aren't genetically engineered at all.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Folks in farm country, what are you hearing from them about even the idea of this kind of consolidation?
I'd say it's a mixed bag. You have a lot of farm groups out there that are letting their opinions be known about it. So you have the American Farm Bureau Federation, which represents more traditional farmers on larger acreages. And they tend to be a little bit more sympathetic to these kinds of deals, but still wary, in part because bigger farms might be able to buy larger quantities of pesticides and seeds and negotiate a better deal with a larger entity. Farmers who work at smaller and medium-sized farms are probably a bit more skeptical because they fear higher pesticide and seed prices, and they tend to have really tight margins. You know, like I said, half of Monsanto's business is vegetable seeds. So anything that happens within that larger corporate farm economy eventually does trickle down to the food that we eat.
And what about the whole job situation? I can't even imagine the number of employees that these six companies have. Will there be a lot of redundancies?
That would be my guess. And one of the things that's been talked about with the Monsanto-Bayer deal is that if there was a shuffle and if these companies were to merge, the name Monsanto would probably disappear. That was something that got brought up in some wheeling and dealing that happened last year between Syngenta and Monsanto, where Monsanto actually suggested it change its name. And, you know, you can probably guess as to why that is.
Yeah, wouldn't be a bad thing for them. And so the end result is that with two of the mergers that are happening with foreign companies acquiring American companies, all of a sudden these businesses, which have been huge American stalwarts, would now be owned overseas.
Yeah. And you've seen that in a lot of sectors. I mean, if you just look at beer, you had Budweiser being bought by InBev, which is a Belgian company. This isn't something that is new, but it's something that hasn't necessarily been part of the farm economy.
So let's talk about what Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack had to say about this when you sat down with him.
Yeah, he was pretty cagey. He did not want to talk about this. I asked three times to talk about these particular deals, which are on the minds of a lot of farmers. And even in kind of an abstract sense of what consolidation in biotech and chemical production would mean for farmers, he just did not want to go there. He did talk a bit about providing choice in the marketplace, but it was a pretty vague answer when I was lobbying out these specific mergers. And these are deals that would affect a lot of his department, the USDA, his constituency, which are farmers, big and small. So I was a little surprised that he wasn't ready to weigh in, considering that these kinds of mega mergers are on the minds of a lot of people within agriculture.
It's interesting because I just read an article talking about how when the new administration comes in, that actually mergers like this might be given more closer scrutiny.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to say. It'll really depend on who wins this election. The Obama administration has been a little bit more willing to step in with antitrust enforcement and put the kibosh on some deals that people had a lot of concerns about. It'll just depend on who wins that election.
And what about us? What about consumers? What do we need to know if these deals go forward?
It's really hard to say how it'll eventually affect consumers in terms of food prices or what you'll see at, you know, a local farmer's market or at the grocery store. Like I mentioned, one of the interesting parts of this deal would be that the Monsanto name would disappear, which I think would have really interesting cultural and social implications. I think a lot of people have made these big biotech firms out to be the boogeyman or out to be these evil corporations. And so if you see the name itself, Monsanto, disappear, it might upend some of those ideas and force people to maybe relook at some of these issues within the agricultural sector. That said, you know, you've got Obama's time in office that's starting to wind down. The administration might be saying we shouldn't just give a rubber stamp to these deals, but we should actually give them a little bit more scrutiny, knowing that the eventuality is going to be that it's going to upend the food system that we rely on.
Wow. Well, it sounds like we're definitely going to have to wait and see. But thank you so much for sharing all that information with us.
Thanks so much, Evan.
That was Luke Runyon. He's a reporter for Harvest Public Media and KUNC in Colorado. You can find a link to his coverage of the Farm Beat on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, we consider a rather strange question. Could air have a place-based atmospheric flavor? That's when the show continues. Stay close.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Terroir. In wine jargon, it is everything. The character of a particular grape or bottle derived from the place where it was grown. The same can be said for miroir when it comes to oysters. But what about air? We breathe it, but does it have a place-based atmospheric flavor too? Nicola Twilley is the author of the blog Edible Geography. She's co-host of the award-winning podcast Gastropod and a contributing writer for The New Yorker. She's here to talk to us about this concept of terroir. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, Evan.
So you've described terroir as the atmospheric taste of place. How did this idea start to come to you?
Well, actually, it started to come together because of an experiment, a project done by an artist friend of mine, Zach Denfeld. He was living in Bangalore at the time, and he was reading On Food and Cooking, the great Harold McGee book. And he got to the chapter about eggs, read that at the stiff peak stage, meringue batter is 90% air, and he went out into the streets of Bangalore and made meringues to try and find where the dirtiest air in the city was. And I saw this project and I thought, that's amazing. How fantastic. But I wanted to do more. Immediately, I wanted to taste, well, how does Bangalore compare to Beijing? And could you taste the air of the past, the real London pea supers that you hear about in history, or even Los Angeles in the 50s and 60s? And so I thought about this and thought, well, scientists must have a way of making smog in the lab. And worked with some scientists at UC Riverside to see how they do that. You know, they told me, well, wow, the first smog scientists were actually flavor scientists. They considered sort of the taste of the air as the problem that they were addressing. And so the more I started looking into it, I thought, you know, air does have a taste. And how about we try to think about ways to make that experience more tangible for people?
Okay, wait. I just want to go back to the beginning of that thought. The first scientists to explore smog were flavor scientists?
That's right. I was amazed when I discovered that, too. It was a scientist called Ari Hagen-Schmidt. He was known for his work on synthetic pineapple flavors. And the reason that he was sort of uniquely equipped to become a smog scientist, really the father of air pollution science, they call him, is because the flavor scientists had the equipment that was delicate enough, that was refined enough to analyze these tiny, tiny particles in the air and figure out what they were.
There's a quote from him that I find just hilarious and appalling all at the same time. I am engaged at the present time on a super flavor problem, the flavor of Los Angeles.
Exactly. And you really can. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't in LA at the time, but I'm assuming you really could taste it.
You could absolutely taste it. Oh, my gosh. I can bring myself back to that time walking home from school just by imagining that flavor. I have to ask you a technical question, though. When you make the meringues, so the flavor of the air stays even after it's baked?
Oh, yes, it absolutely does. Because what you're doing is you're capturing those little air bubbles in the meringue batter, and then you just put them straight in the oven. And of course, the little air bubbles stay there because that's what makes your meringue structure. And so the chemicals, the trace chemicals that are giving it that smog flavor stay in there too. So yes, I can tell you from personal experience that the smogs taste very, very different.
Okay, so what are the ingredients that we're able to taste in edible smog?
It varies depending on what kind of smog you're making. So Los Angeles, for example, in the 1950s, or on a bad day today, or say Mexico City as well today, that's a particular kind of smog. They call it a photochemical smog. And what you're tasting is what happens when hydrocarbons and nitrogen dioxide react together under sunlight. And that produces a lot of ozone, few other chemicals, but it's primarily ozone. So that actually gives the smog that forms over LA, over Mexico City, gives it almost a bleachy taste. People who taste the smog meringue from LA say to us, it sort of tastes like toilet cleaner.
Wow. Okay, so contrast that with a different smog.
Well, an interesting smog is an agricultural smog. So we make a smog from California's Central Valley. Not to pick on California here. We make a lot of other smogs too. But parts of the Central Valley have some of the worst air quality in America. And I think people don't realize it's, you know, this agricultural powerhouse, but it's also sat between two mountain ranges. And the air gets really bad there. But it's very different from the hydrocarbons and the nitrogen dioxide you get in a city. It's more ammonia and amines from the feedlots, from the fields, etc. So when we make that, it looks very different. It smells very different. It's actually alkaline rather than acid. It's not barnyardy. I think that's too positive towards it. It's really just fetid.
Oh gosh, what is the most polluted city that you've been able to taste?
Well, we make a Beijing, and that is really pretty bad. It has a lot of soot and particulate matter as well, which give the meringues a really gritty crunch to them. It's quite unpleasant. That just tastes dirty. Your mouth feels dirty afterwards. So that's as bad as it gets, I think. I mean, LA is quite pleasant compared to that.
I'm just curious, have you ever or do you want to in the future do the opposite and sort of capture edible loveliness, like in a beautiful garden or at the top of a pristine ski slope or...
Yes. I mean, I think people actually suggested, you know, you should have a forest just sort of as a palate cleanser or so by way of contrast. And I actually think that that's exactly right. Now, we did, working with Zach Denfeld, the artist whose idea the smog meringue originally was, we did put together a dinner up at the Headlands Center for the Art where we explored some of the nicer aspects of terroir and looked into, for example, we distilled fog and then used lichens as the bitters because they're an air plant. So we tried to create some other ways to taste it that weren't just pollution, but got at some other aspects of ways to taste the air around us.
Well, I just have to thank you for your intellectual curiosity, for exploring this subject so thoroughly.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest. Yeah.
That was Nicola Twilley. Her award-winning podcast is Gastropod, and her blog is Edible Geography. We've got links to both on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, it's time for the Market Report. Let's find out what's in season in Santa Monica this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. As we're celebrating Memorial Weekend, everybody's outside. We're celebrating the season. We're celebrating, as usual, the farmer's market. I'm talking now with Travis Strickland, who's the executive chef at Baltaire in Brentwood. Travis, you're here shopping for Memorial Day menu items. Tell us what you're going to be shopping for.
Well, we're here looking for beets today. We've been developing recently a new vegetarian side item that we can offer at Baltaire. So we're looking for beets and kind of all different types of beets, yellow, red, candy stripe beets. And what we're working on with the beets is trying to kind of put a new interesting spin on them by smoking them. So it's kind of, I think it's appropriate for the Memorial Day weekend. And, you know, it's certainly something that people maybe don't think of grilling or taking outside with them. But the result of the beets after being smoked or grilled is really intoxicating because they become almost kind of like a sponge, and they really soak up a lot of those flavors.
So they're not wrapped in foil when they're in the smoker?
No. Just put them directly on the grate, expose them to that nice smoke, and it really is kind of just set it and forget it after that.
Do you use a certain kind of wood?
Yeah, for these, we played around with a lot of different woods. Some are more aggressive than others, but we found that we liked pecan wood when we smoked these, which is kind of interesting. It's subtle. It has a little kind of undertones of fruit, but it still has that kind of intoxicating backyard smoky aroma and flavor when you're done.
Do you oil them first?
Yeah, just toss them lightly and season generously with salt and pepper, and then they're ready to go in the smoker.
And tell me what you like about the flavor of the beets.
For me, beets are incredibly sweet. They're almost candy-like without adding anything to them. Yeah, they taste a little like the earth, but that's kind of the reason why we like them. You know, to kind of create a round dish that hits on everything, it's got acid, it's got salt, it's got sweet, it's got some of those things. The beet has a lot of those things kind of inherently in it. As we talked about the sugar, and it's got that earthiness, so it pairs well with herbaceous things, fresh herbs. It pairs well with dairy. We like to use yogurt as kind of a flavor base to go along with the beets. So that's one of the things I like, is the versatility and the willingness of the beet to accept other flavors.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And then those greens that are so tasty and good. What do you do with those?
Well, at the restaurant, you know, I have to consistently tell the cooks that's good eating. I said, don't get rid of those greens. Save them, wash them. If they're going into a salad or if we're going to saute or braise them. You know, I did a lot of time cooking in the South, and turnip greens and mustard greens and collard greens and those things, they're revered because of their health properties and the benefits that they provide. You know, it has that kind of, you know, semi-bitter flavor at the end that kind of gets cooked out and mellows a little bit when you cook it, but they're tender and they're delicious. The best part about cooking greens is what's called the pot liquor that comes out. The liquid that they release in the pan is actually the most nutritious part of the whole thing. So that's, you know, in the South, when you would get sick, the grandmother would give you some pot liquor to drink because there's so many vitamins in there.
And then when you cook the beet greens and you serve them, you just pour that back over the top?
That's the best part of the entire thing. It's a little salty. It's, you know, got some of those nutrients, and you can taste it in the pot liquor.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, great. It's so good to know that the beets are getting some love.
Thank you very much.
All right, Travis, thank you so much. That was Travis Strickland. He is executive chef at Baltaire in Brentwood, and he's teaching us to love smoked beets for Memorial Day. One of the places that Travis likes to get his beets is Ruti's Farm here in Santa Monica. It's located in Arroyo Grande, and Chris Edwards, who is the farm manager, is at the market pretty much every week now with a beautiful display of Ruti's produce. And you grow the beets. Today you have two kinds of beets on your table. Tell us about how long beets take to grow and how you grow them.
Well, that's an excellent question. Beets take a considerably long time to grow. Usually we see about 90 days, more or less, depending on the variety. And the types of beets that we grow right now are golden beets, Chioggias, and like your typical Detroit Reds.
Do you, when you plant your beets at Ruti's Farm, do you do it every 90 days so you always have some beets growing?
Usually I plant every couple weeks or so. And so, yeah, we typically always have beets somewhere in the ground. Because they take so long, it's nice to have the ones on, you know, on backup. And they do well just sitting in the ground, you know. We can leave them there for a little while. They're going to size up. Sometimes the beet tops die off, but at that point, we just sell the beets as a loose beet, which a lot of people prefer anyway, even though the greens are delicious.
Some people think that beets, if they're left in the ground too long, they lose flavor or they develop an off flavor. Mm-hmm. How do you know when the beet is like ready to pick?
I generally just look for a nice sizable beet. Once they get to a tennis ball size, that's about average what I like to get them out of the ground. Some people like them a little bit bigger. I don't typically see a lot of flavor decrease when they get a little bit bigger like that.
Is this one of the crops that you're going to plant from seed?
That it is. Basically, the way it works is I have an implement on the tractor that I fill up with all the seeds, and there's different size holes on this implement that when I run over the bed, it distributes the seeds out as it goes. So typically, the spacing I have right now, I'm going to get about 3 to 4 seeds every inch or two, more or less.
Okay, and of those, you're going to be thinning them out to about 3 inches apart or so?
More or less, yeah, maybe two. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have to dig them out with a big fork, or do you pull them up by the greens?
No, typically we just pull them up by the greens. If you get it right at the base there where the greens meet the beet, ideally you can just pull it right out of the ground. Depends on how dry your soil is. We usually try to pre-irrigate before we pull out our beets.
Right. Are they different flavors depending on if it's hot weather or cold weather?
Yes, you get different flavors, and especially with the varieties. You know, with the ones that we grow, that typical Detroit red is going to be a really sweet, earthy flavor. Now, with the Chioggias, they're a little bit more earthy, but without as much of the sweetness. So I guess it all depends on what sort of dish you're trying to make.
Do you ever eat them raw?
Yeah, I eat them raw all the time.
Like pull it out of the ground and eat it like an apple raw?
No, it's a little tough. There are some people that do that, but I'll cut them in little slivers and eat that.
Okay, Chris, well, I hope you're going to get to taste Travis's smoked beets one of these days, and we're going to look forward to tasting the beets you bring here year-round here at the Wednesday Market. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
That was Chris Edwards. He is the farm manager at Ruti's Farms up in Arroyo Grande, and in addition to the beets, come by and check out their stand. They do have a bunch of gorgeous produce. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Travis Strickland's recipe for smoked roasted beets will be on the Good Food blog for you. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we find out where our favorite food critic is dining this week. Stay with us.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. It's that time of the show again, the time when we turn to Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, for a restaurant recommendation. Jonathan, where are we headed?
We're going to Hollywood, to the newly relocated Saltzcure.
Okay, remind us where Saltzcure was before and what sort of the paradigm of the restaurant was in its former location.
Saltzcure was in a storefront on Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood. And it was a place that, frankly, for the first few months I went there, I couldn't figure out whether it was a restaurant that sold some sort of charcuterie or whether it was a butcher shop that happened to sell dinner sometimes.
Yeah, they were one of the first to do whole animal and really commit to it.
Right. They were finding, you know, really good meat from all over the state and butchering it in-house and doing sort of interesting charcuterie. Different from other people, I think they were using almost no nitrates and very little salt. And if you're used to sort of punch you in the face flavors of, you know, Southern Italian charcuterie, for example, it might have seemed a little bland, but it had character.
And always fresh pickles made by them to accompany.
Yeah, fresh pickles. They were definitely ahead of the game on the fermenting.
So who are we talking about?
The chefs are Chris Phelps and Zach Walters, who have been floating around for a while, but have been at Saltzcure for quite a while.
It's always a little iffy when a successful restaurant that gets packed regularly decides to change locale.
Right, especially because the original location seemed so informal. Most of the seating seemed to be at the counter. The tables were sort of haphazardly thrown in there. Sometimes there was a 2-hour wait for brunch if you hadn't thought to reserve in advance. But by the time you did sit down, even at brunch, and you had those beautiful, crisp-edged, buttery, grainy oatmeal pancakes, always forgiven.
Yeah. One of the best brunches in town, for sure. And even if you sat at a table away from the counter, you felt like you were at the counter because the place was so small.
Right. At the original Saul Skewer, it never seemed like they had a menu. There was a blackboard. And if you were interested in eating there, you would go to their Facebook page and there'd be a picture of the blackboard with what they were serving that night. At the new Saul Skewer, there's also a blackboard. But it's more for specials or for interesting cuts of meat that they've got in. There's a sort of everyday menu that you can count on existing from week to week.
Are they open every day for breakfast now?
They're open every day from 11, but the brunch menu is basically just Saturdays and Sundays still.
Yeah, and then they open, I think, an hour earlier at 10.
Right.
What is the major shift other than comfort of the customer and, of course, a bigger kitchen for them to do what they're doing? What's the major shift in this new space?
One of the things would have to be their cocktail program. You know, there's a bar. There's day drinking. They're open constantly from 11 o'clock on. So if you want to sit and drink a martini or an old-fashioned, they're there. Good place for day drinking.
So let's talk about the food.
The first thing you should probably know about Saul Skewer is what you probably already do know is that it's a meat place. And when we're talking meat, the beef is excellent, but it's very pork driven. So the pork chop, which is from Marin Sun, which is a sustainable grass-fed operation up north, is just a beautiful pork chop. It's 16 ounces. It's seasoned with salt and pepper, and I don't believe anything else. You know, a little bit of a cure to it, so the meat is set up a little bit. And it's just there, plain on a plate. It's just you and the pork chop.
It's probably the best pork chop in the city.
I think it's the best pork chop in the
yeah.
city. And, you know, the Kiesbacher pork chop is quite a pork chop. So to be better than that is, it's nice. It's an accomplishment.
What else did you really enjoy?
They do a duck leg. It's sort of confit that they serve with a stack of the pancakes from brunch, which I think is sort of brilliant. You have something, you do it well, everybody likes it. Why not serve it with a duck leg as well as with, you know, bacon at breakfast? There's a nice half chicken, super simple, roasted. The skin has that, you know, slightly crispy, slightly tacky thing that you get from chicken. And a beautiful white sausage with sauerkraut and apple.
Oh, that sounds good. I haven't had that.
They make their own sausage. They smoke and cure their own bacon for breakfast. But it isn't just meat there. There's grilled asparagus, the really fat kind, that comes under a blanket of hard-boiled egg and roasted almonds. And I know I'm not a huge fan of hard-boiled eggs. I can brush them off, but I can see why people appreciate it as a spring thing. There are bowls of cold tomato soup, dense enough to resemble a sauce more than they do a soup, that are served with, you know, perfect little wedges of grilled cheese sandwich. There are very nice French fries that are, like, dusted with spices.
And they always have a nice selection of fish, too.
And they always have a nice selection of fish. You know, I like that they call it a plank salmon. And it's not the kind that you may remember that Campanile had as a special for 10,000 years. It's a well-used plank. The fish is cooked to flakiness. It's not transparent anymore. Comes with, you know, a little smear of sauce. A couple of times I was there was on the special board, there was a veal segreto.
Ooh.
I've always heard of segreto coming from a pig. It's like one of those cuts hidden inside a pork shoulder. But I hadn't heard of a veal one and was served really simply with brown butter. And I never think of putting brown butter on veal, but it seems to work. The other thing that you should probably keep in mind is the portions are on the small side, which I think is good because really nobody needs to go to a place and eat 2 pounds of meat. Because portions are on the small side, it leaves you with both the capacity and the desire for dessert and the grapefruit pie, which is sort of like a key lime pie, but with grapefruit instead of the key lime. A few slivers of candied grapefruit peel on top. And this beautiful sort of haunting bitterness of grapefruit peel that lingers long after you finish it. It's a really nice way to finish a meal.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about salt's cure in Hollywood. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. So yes, it is Memorial Day weekend, and for lots of us, that means popping open a cold one and sipping it al fresco with some friends. This year, what about making that cold one a beer cocktail? After all, Boilermakers and Micheladas are beer cocktails, and they are the perfect storm of craft cocktail and craft beer in a glass. Here to enlighten us on this refreshing subject is bartender Jacob Greer. He's the author of Cocktails on Tap. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me on.
I understand that there are quite a few different categories. Were a lot of the recipes, like, mentioned in literature?
A lot of them were, yeah, especially in books like from Charles Dickens. His great-grandson actually wrote a book called Drinking with Dickens that talks about the drinking culture that existed during his time. And we also have references to Shakespeare. But yeah, it seems like beer cocktails pop up in literature all the time.
So interesting. Well, first take us through the seven categories so we can sort of get a base.
Cool. Well, the first ones I just call prepared beers, which are the ones you mentioned earlier, things like a Boilermaker or a Michelada, where you take a beer, probably a pretty straightforward beer like a lager, and you spice it up somehow. Maybe that's with like in a Michelada with hot sauce and lime juice, or maybe in a Boilermaker just by adding a shot. Or if you want to do it the French way, you could do Picon beer, which would be like a French lager with a liqueur called a Mère Picon. Then you can get a little bit more complicated with, say, a beer-topped cocktail where you take a cocktail base and then you top it with a beer that is complementary to it. Or even a beer-incorporated cocktail, which are some of my favorites, where you just treat beer like any other cocktail ingredient and you shake it up. One of my favorites is the Mai Tai PA, which is a classic Mai Tai, but with a little IPA shaken into it to give it a little bitterness and just a little bit of frothiness and aroma. Then we have fun with beer syrups. We have several recipes in the book that make syrups out of, say, a raspberry lambic. And we even have an orgeat made out of Imperial Russian Stout, which is basically taking hot beer and steeping blanched almonds in it. And you get this kind of almond milk beer that you can use in cocktails.
That sounds really delicious.
It's a lot of fun. I'm glad I have that at home to keep on hand. Then there's punches. Two of the stranger ones would be flips. Flips today we think of as drinks that are made with a whole egg and served cold. But back in colonial times, it would have been a drink that's served hot with beer. And it would have been made by taking a red-hot poker and dipping it into a tankard of beer with sugar and really funky rum. And then that brings us to the last category, which is hot beer drinks, or hot helpers, as they're sometimes called. We ended up devoting an entire chapter of the book to beer drinks that are served hot.
But it seems to me that that makes perfect sense. Because beer back in the day, wasn't it kind of drunk instead of water? So it was a very ubiquitous drink?
It was everywhere. Even the kids were on it. You know, they would have, one of the books I found was recommending in colonial U.S. that kids start the day with a little brown bread and a little bit of ale. So everyone was drinking beer. And the beer, of course, is very different. It was much maltier and less hoppy than the beers we would think of today. It probably wasn't as fermented as fully, so there would be some residual sugar. So think of it more as a sweet, malty beer as opposed to, say, the hoppy IPA or a thin lager like we might drink today. And when you make that hot, it can taste very good, especially with spices added, or if it's not for the kids, if you're adding rum or whiskey or something like that.
To me, a lot of these particularly hot beer cocktails are almost like food.
They are. A lot of the old drinks were kind of crossing the line between food and drink, and it wasn't always clear, is this a drink, is this food? They were called ale meal sometimes. And the idea was, one, you may be poor, or two, you may be weary from traveling, and so you don't want to drink just neat spirits. The strangest one that we talked about is posset, which you come across in books all the time, like in Shakespeare, it was in Hamlet and Macbeth. Posset is mentioned in both of those. And it was made by making beer hot and then pouring it into milk or cream and causing it to curdle. And so the person who was consuming it would drink the warm, creamy liquid off the bottom and then also spoon the curds off the top. Today, I'd suggest leaving the curds aside and just skimming those off and drinking the posset. But it's surprisingly good if it's made correctly.
Let's talk about beer syrups because, you know, being a person who loves to bake, I just think in my head, beer syrup and gingerbread, that would be really good.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. The winter spices and beer can go together really well. So, yeah, I would maybe try that with a malty English ale like Samuel Smith Winter Welcome. That's one of my favorites.
When you get rid of the carbonation, which must happen when you're making the syrup as you boil it, what flavors come forward?
Well, one of the things that happens is you, especially when you heat it up, you accentuate any bitter flavors that are in the beer. So if you're doing something hot, I tend to avoid anything that's really, really hoppy and go for the maltier, sweeter, or fruitier styles. And like you said, you lose the carbonation, which would kind of make it lighter. So you end up with a much thicker, heavier syrup at the end.
How do you use it in cocktails?
We do several ways. The easiest way would be to make a syrup and just treat it like you would a cocktail syrup, like a grenadine or an orgeat, which is the almond syrup. Then you can just add it to a drink, and you can stir it in if it's a drink like an old-fashioned. We actually have a Geneva old-fashioned in the book that's made with a Rauschbier syrup, which is a smoky, dark beer from Germany. Or you can shake it in. We have a gin sour that's made with a raspberry beer syrup. And then that Imperial Stout d'Argent, which is a very strange drink that's not really like anything else, with a really strong rum and sherry.
Jacob, I'd love to go back to the category of flips. There's so much drama in their preparations, isn't there?
There is, especially if you make it with the very old way. Today we think of flips as any drink that's made by shaking an egg into a cocktail. But if you go back to the original definition in colonial times, it would have meant a drink that's served hot, and it's made with beer and probably no eggs. The original flips were just beer and rum and sugar, and they would be heated up with this tool called a loggerhead, which was originally made for stirring tar, but it would be this metal pole with a big metal ball at the end that you would stick in the fireplace. And it would get smoking hot, and then you would dip that into your tankard of ale and rum and sugar, and the whole thing just froths up dramatically. And it caramelizes the sugars and creates these amazing aromas. And that was where the flip originated.
These days, given that in so many bars there is a lot of performance to being a bartender, are you actually sticking a red hot poker into a glass?
I have. I've usually a metal pitcher. I don't do it with glass, just to be safe. I've done it at a couple events now here in Portland, and it's very dramatic, and it gets a lot of attention. It's not very practical for bar service. You either have to have a fireplace, and then it takes a long time to get it back up to temperature every time, or you need a torch, which I've also used, sitting outside with a torch that just gets really hot, and I sit there and heat it up and put it into the pitcher and then do it again over and over. So it's a lot of fun. It's not the most practical method if your bar is busy at all.
This has been so much fun, Jacob. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, and thank you for your enthusiasm about beer cocktails.
Love them. Jacob Greer's blog is Liquidity Preference. Want to try your hand at making a beer flip at home? We've got the recipe for you. It's on the Good Food blog. And don't worry, it's adapted for the home drinkers, so no fireplace or torch required. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, we move from hops to something a tad sweeter. Stay with us.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Take a California girl with stints as an assistant to a Hollywood director to navigating the simplicity and intricacy of the pastry department of Chez Panisse. And who do you get? Claire Patak. Despite having gigs that most in those given industries would kill for, Claire headed across the pond where she's owned and operated the Violet Bakery in East London for the last 10 years. She believes that every mouthful of cake should be worth it. And with her first cookbook, she keeps it simple and satisfying. Hi, Claire.
Hi.
So, I mean, it's so fascinating because, living here in California, and especially Southern California, we're so used to an influx of people from all over the world coming here.
Yeah, of course.
So what made you not just go, because I understand, traveling and experimenting and even staging, but what made you commit to inserting yourself into this whole other world of London?
I'd always had a bit of a love affair with England. I had a really wonderful woman that she worked in a shop near my mom. My mom had a shop when I was growing up, and she worked in a shop that was connected to it. And after school, I hung out there a lot. Her name was Valerie Lindsdale, and I used to spend so much time with her, and I loved her accent, and I loved her stories, and her. She always drank tea, of course. And I think that got me started, and then I just had a lot of connections to England, and then I ended up falling in love with an English man, so that got me there.
And what's interesting about the fact that you worked at Chez Panisse is I think so many people, when they focus on Chez Panisse, pastry and desserts isn't what immediately springs to mind.
Mm. I think the most important thing that I learned there was about balance of flavor and taste and using incredible produce to get a really good result. And Alice always says, you know, you can't make something delicious if you don't start out with a delicious ingredient.
And are your cakes, just to give us an idea of your style, are your cakes like slathered with icing and elaborate decoration?
No. We do some buttercream in the shop for sure. But all our buttercreams are made with fruits, actually, or caramel or chocolate. I don't use any food coloring. So it's, you know, the pink comes from raspberry or the purple comes from Concord grape or, you know, and so on. And so there is that. And then there's a lot of bakery brown, I like to call it, which is the...
I've never heard that before.
That lovely brown that it seems to be ubiquitous. But it feels like the kind of comforting baked goods that you crave or you remember having at home. That's sort of the idea.
I understand that you have discovered two palettes of sweet.
This is something that I sort of came up with because my husband is the type of person who wants caramel and something that the English call treacle all the time, which is sort of sticky and gooey and... caramelly sort of flavors or chocolate flavors, rich and very satisfying and not necessarily so sweet, but just that kind of texture. The English actually call desserts pudding. And I think that it's really interesting because so many of their really good puddings or desserts are quite soft and gooey. And so I started to think about it in relation to my taste, which is very much the apple galette or plum tart or something fruit-based. And I thought it's really that people have these two different palates. And so when I was starting the business, I was making a lot of fruit-based items. And my husband kept saying, yeah, it's okay. It's pretty good. But can't you do something more treacly? You know? So I realized I really needed to listen to that. And it was really helpful in my business because then I created a much broader menu that would appeal to these two different types. And it is quite remarkable because people come in and they just are drawn to one or the other. And it's very rare that they like both.
Have you come up with any mashup desserts that have sort of the best of both?
Actually, the spelt cake in the book is kind of like that because it's almond and spelt flour, and then you put tons of fruit and there's a bit of sugar on top. And so it gets kind of gooey and melty in that kind of unctuous treacle way, but it's got fruit.
So spelt flour, these days it seems that bakers are experimenting with so many different kinds of flours. Are you also embracing that world?
Yeah, I've been doing it for a few years now, and I think one of the reasons why so many of us are embracing it is because there's been so many improvements to the milling of these grains. It's really exciting, and a lot of our customers are asking for it because people are avoiding gluten. Many more people are diagnosed with celiac disease now. And also, you know, the thing about white flour is that it's highly processed and...
it's a dead thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so whilst I still love white flour, and also because what I love about white flour is that it doesn't have a flavor. So whatever you're cooking with or baking with... you can really enhance the flavor of that thing. So if it is a fruit or it is a chocolate or whatever, you get that pure flavor. When you work with these alternative grains, it's really about working with that flavor and balancing that flavor. So rather than trying to substitute or mask it, I really try to let it stand out and find things that go with it. So it's been fun. I love it.
So maybe take us through the evolution of your rye chocolate brownies.
Okay. We actually used to make a brownie with spelt flour that is totally delicious and still make it sometimes. Actually, I was, and I mentioned this in the book, I was reading Chad Robertson's Tartine 3, I think it is, and he talks about chocolate and rye and their affinity for each other. And so I thought, oh, yeah, that would be so good in a brownie. And I tried it, and I used a wholemeal rye flour, so really kind of coarse. And I love the results. It's chewy. It makes it kind of this chewiness, and there's a wonderful flavor to the rye that works really well with dark chocolate and lots of salt.
So, oh, that sounds wonderful.
It's nice.
When I was reading that you love foraging fig leaves, I kind of got excited because I have a huge fig tree in my yard.
Oh, you're so lucky.
And it still has a lot of leaves on it.
Yeah.
So how do you incorporate them into a recipe?
One of my favorite things to make is fig leaf ice cream.
Ooh.
And we also make a fig leaf custard for cakes, for a filling for cakes. And so I infuse it into cream or coconut milk, just like you would for, you know, any kind of ice cream infusion. And we bake the leaves a little bit first just to kind of pull that flavor out. And it's amazing. They have a real coconutty flavor, the fig leaf. And I discovered them, again, at Chez Panisse. They used to wrap, or they do wrap, them around fish. So you bake fish in fig leaves. It just suddenly transforms into this sort of beautiful tropical thing. And I thought that would be so good in desserts. So that's kind of where it came from.
Claire, it's been such a pleasure meeting you.
Oh, likewise, Evan. Thank you so much.
Claire Patak is the owner of the Violet Bakery in East London and the author of the Violet Bakery Cookbook, a book, I should say, that is one of Jonathan Gold's favorite dessert cookbooks. You can find a recipe for her rye chocolate brownies on the Good Food blog. Luis Sanchez is an LA street vendor who goes by the name Grace of the Sea. Grace sells bacon-wrapped pineapple-stuffed hot dogs in Jefferson Park a couple days a week and candy out of a golden basket. Today on Good Food, we're going to ride along with Grace on her candy route. Producer David Weinberg is our guide.
Muchachos, pasen buenas tardes. Tenemos especiales.
Right at this moment, Grace of the Sea is performing a sort of complicated dance, trying to do two opposing things at once. Advertise her candy by singing and yelling to potential customers.
Ouch! Te quise.
And she's trying to hide from security. She ducks into a stall that sells fabric and hides behind a row of mannequin legs.
He always like, you know, hey, what are you doing?
Sometimes when she sees the security guard, she pretends that he's her bodyguard.
So I feel like Whitney Houston and he's my bodyguard.
Grace isn't allowed to sell here in this part of the fashion district. And actually, she isn't allowed to sell anywhere in Los Angeles. And actually, she isn't allowed to be in the United States at all. She's undocumented. So just her presence on the streets is illegal. Grace peeks out from behind the mannequin legs, looks both ways, then walks around the corner and bursts into song. Today, Grace is dressed in black and silver. She's wearing a black top hat with a silver sequined scarf. The scarf matches her blouse, and over that, she has a flowing black dress. But from the waist down, it's a very different outfit. Jeans and tennis shoes.
People say to me, why don't you wear heels? You look wonderful on your top, but on the bottom, look at you, you're having tennis shoes and jeans. Since I walk, I'm going to work. You're going to see it. We're going to walk a lot. But we'll have a snack on the way, and it'll be fun.
There are other parts of the fashion district where Grace is more welcome. A lot of her regular customers are store owners and employees like the ones at this tailor shop, where dozens of older Hispanic men and women sit hunched over sewing machines.
Buenas tardes, don Mike. Buenas tardes, señora.
Grace walks in with her golden basket, greets the room, and starts making sales. Peanuts, gum, Mexican lollipops, cookies, and borrachines, which look like Legos dusted with sugar. They're dulce de leche candies made with liquor. We pop into the dress shop next door, where a teenage girl twirls in front of a mirror in a sequined prom dress.
Is that beautiful, like Cinderella, girl? Wow.
Grace hasn't always been a street vendor. She's worked in restaurants and hotels, but her first job ever was back before Luis took on the name Grace, He was 10 years old, selling gum on the streets of Morelia, a small town in the central Mexican state of Michoacán. Grace's mom, Maria, encouraged her 13 kids to sell on the streets. They needed the money. One of Luis's older brothers shined shoes.
And what did I say? I'm not going out to clean people's shoes. You know what I did? I bought a pack of gum. So the two of us went out to sell together. Me with my gum and him with the shoe shine.
When Luis was a little older, he went out with his mom to sell sopes on the weekends.
The salsa was really good because I ground it on the grindstone. I ground the chili on the grindstone like a mortar and pestle with a rock, and it would come out so good.
As we head out of the fashion district through the toy district, Grace sells to several of her regulars who have stalls in the indoor mall. Then we hop on the bus and head east to the wholesale produce market at East 8th and Central.
And this is the place where I also show them my underwear, but you're here, Alexandra. And they love to see me when I dance and show them, but not today, okay?
Normally, Grace would pull down her pants just a little and show off her thong to the men who work here. But today, because my producer Alexandra is with us, Grace doesn't want to be crass in front of a lady. Instead, she walks into the big refrigerated warehouse and picks out a pineapple, some tomatillos, and some berries.
And I get whatever I want, like he says, and because they get also whatever they want from the basket. It's like exchanging.
While Grace loads up, the men take a few packages of gum from the candy basket.
See how much they love me? You see how much, you see how the people love me and I love, it's magic.
From here, we head towards downtown. Grace hits a bunch of places along Broadway. And then, her final stop, the entrance to Grand Central Market. From there, we walk a few blocks towards Chinatown and sit on a concrete window ledge. Grace counts her money for the day.
87, 89, 90, 93, 93. See, it's like the bus is coming.
Today was a really good day for Grace, one of her best, actually. She made $93 in 7 hours. About 50 of that is profit, so she made a little more than $7 an hour. On days like today, when she does really well, Grace likes to treat herself. There's a place she loves in Chinatown that has a $5 lunch special that goes till 5 p.m. We make it just in time. Grace sits down and a waiter brings hot tea and soup, places it on the white tablecloth. Grace smiles and orders her favorite dish, Kung Pao squid. As the waiter heads back to the kitchen, Grace points to my microphone and says, let's forget about the recording. Yes. Let's enjoy our food. Mm.
The beef chop suey looks good too. This one here.
What's that?
For you, you don't want the pork chops?
Producer David Weinberg's Grace of the Sea is part of KCRW's series Below the 10, Stories of South L.A. Hear more stories of South L.A. at kcrw.com/below the 10. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress Swanson, Laro Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Messiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.